Hi everyone. Before I begin the episode, I would like to provide another plug for a huge event I'll be appearing at only 1 month from now. On Sunday, August the 18th, I will be participating in a true crime podcasting event at the Royal Cinema in downtown Toronto. The event will run from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m., and in addition to myself, other podcasters participating will include Christy from Canadian True Crime, Jordan from the Nighttime Podcast, Nina from Already Gone, and Aaron from Generation Y. I'm also excited to announce that Canadian criminologist and author Lee Meller from the Murder Was the Case podcast will now be joining us as well for a chat, along with true crime author Nate Henley. The main focus of our show will be presenting the case of the Donnellys, the well-known historic Canadian story of a gritty and brutal pioneer feud. The story is surrounded by myth and legend. It was chronicled in Nate Henley's book Black Donnellys, but join us to find out what really happened. In addition, there will also be a meet-and-greet and a Q&A on the show. And while I'm here, I also want to send out a big thank you to the Royal Cinema, who are partnering with us for this event and have been so nice and helpful. I used to go see movies at the Royal all the time while I was attending university in Toronto, so you cannot imagine how excited I am to be participating in an actual show there. If you're in the Toronto area and love indie and arthouse cinema, you have to check out the Royal. It's an historic cinema in the heart of Toronto's Little Italy with the best of both worlds. It's gone through extensive renovations and upgrades to state-of-the-art audiovisual equipment, but it still boasts gorgeous architecture. The Royal is also known for excellent programming. Their monthly signature series delivers shows which suit all tastes. Some examples include CinemaCob Movie Nights, which showcase classic and contemporary horror, Eastern Promises, which displays the highs and lows of Asian cinema, and Retropath, a showcase of truly bizarre cinema. Those are just a few examples, as there are at least 8 different signature series celebrating cinema, so you'll be sure to find something that you like. To check it out and see what's coming up, just go to theroyal.to or Google The Royal Cinema to follow them on social media. And if you would like to attend our True Crime podcasting event, tickets are only $25, and you can purchase them at nighttime.com/Toronto. You'll also be able to find a link to the website in our episode description. Anyway, we hope to see you on August the 18th. Thanks for listening to our promo for this event, and enjoy the episode. April 30th, 1991. Santa Clara County, California. After spending the night in downtown San Jose with his friend Gene, 36-year-old Dick Hansen notices that he is being watched by a man in a car. When Dick and Gene leave the city in their respective vehicles, they are followed by this man for over 10 miles, prompting Dick to leave the freeway and pull over. When Dick walks over to the man's vehicle to confront him, he is shot twice before the driver flees the scene. Even though Gene is left alive as a witness, the identity of the killer, as well as the motive for his crime, remain unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a pretty famous unsolved mysteries case, the 1991 murder of Dick Hansen, or as some fans like to call it, the 49er Hugs murder. Ever since the inception of this podcast, this has been one of my most highly requested unsolved mysteries cases, as it's one of the more baffling and senseless murders ever featured on the show. This is the frightening story of a guy who went out on a date with his friend Gene before they both noticed that they were being followed by a man they did not recognize. When Dick pulled over to confront him, he became angry over something the motorist said before he was fatally shot. The reason this case has become known as the 49er Hugs murder is because 49er Hugs was written on Gene's personalized license plate in reference to the San Francisco 49ers football team. This has led to speculation that the killer was a disgruntled football fan particularly since Dick was a former college football star who actually bore a resemblance to a player from the 49ers at that time. But if this wasn't a case of mistaken identity, what was the actual motive for this crime? Since there isn't a whole lot of material out there about this case, I'm going to conclude this episode by talking about another famous story from Unsolved Mysteries, which featured another random shooting by a motorist. It took place in Connecticut in 1988, and involved a woman who was shot in the face on her way to work by a crazed man driving a pickup truck. Thankfully, the victim survived the ordeal, but like Dick Hansen's murder, this is another random and seemingly motiveless crime in which the perpetrator was never identified, so both these cases deserve exploration. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved murder of Dick Hansen. Our story begins in California in 1991. Our central figure is 36-year-old Richard Gerald Hansen, who goes by the name Dick. While attending Santa Clara University during the 1970s, Dick was a star player on their football team, though a knee injury would prevent him from turning pro. Even so, Dick always made sure to stay in shape and maintains a large 255-pound frame. Dick currently lives in San Jose and has two daughters, ages 13 and 11, though he went through a tough divorce with their mother years earlier. On the evening of April 29th, Dick decided to go out on a date with a longtime friend of his. Her real name has never been revealed publicly, but on the Unsolved Mysteries segment, she went by the name Jean, so that's what we'll call her here. Dick and Jean had been friends for many years, and had an on-again, off-again relationship, but things hit a rocky patch 2 months earlier, after an incident where Dick got incredibly drunk and yelled at her. As a result, Dick decided to undergo alcohol rehabilitation, and following his recovery, he called up Jean again to see if they could give their relationship another shot. She agreed to travel to downtown San Jose from her home in Belmont to meet Dick for dinner at a restaurant called Original Joe's. They both met there at 10 p.m., and after they had dinner, they decided to go to a nightclub located 5 miles away. They both traveled to the club in Jean's car, well, Dick left his pickup truck parked outside the restaurant. After hanging out for a few hours, they both left the club at around 1:45 a.m. on April the 30th, and Dick drove Jean's car back to the spot where his truck was parked. At this point, the street seemed completely deserted, and Dick and Jean chatted inside her car, but they soon noticed another car pull up behind them. Jean would later describe the vehicle as resembling a two-door 1970 Pontiac GTO Le Mans, with a faded light gray or blue paint job, and it was driven by a white male with a dark complexion who appeared to be in his late 30s or early 40s and wore glasses with large black frames. According to Jean, the man just sat behind the wheel staring at her and Dick as they conversed. Jean wondered if perhaps he was waiting to use the mailbox and asked Dick if he should move the vehicle forward a bit since they were parked right in front of it. But Dick remarked that the guy had plenty of room to use the mailbox, so they continued on with their conversation. Jean invited Dick back to her place in Belmont, but since she was unfamiliar with the route out of San Jose, Dick told her to follow him. Dick then exited the car and climbed into his pickup truck before driving off with Jean following closely behind. However, the man in the vehicle also pulled away from the curb and started following them. When Dick and Jean drove a few blocks and made two separate left turns, the man did the exact same thing and stayed on their tail. Jean said she started to become concerned after she moved into the middle lane and saw the pursuing vehicle move into the middle lane behind her. When she moved back to the right lane seconds later, the vehicle did the exact same thing, which convinced Jean that the driver was deliberately shadowing her. When they stopped at the next traffic light, Dick motioned for Jean to follow him onto Interstate 280, but sure enough, the male motorist continued to follow them onto the freeway and shadow them for the next 10 miles. Whenever Jean changed lanes, the man would immediately do the same thing. Dick and Jean arranged things so that Dick was in the right lane, Jean was in the left lane, and the vehicle was following closely behind in the center lane between them. Jean decided to take the driver by surprise by suddenly slamming on the brakes, but once again, he completely copied her by slamming on the brakes as well. Jean subsequently pulled up next to Dick, honked the horn, and rolled down her window to suggest they go to the police, but Dick did not seem to hear her. Instead, he told Jean that he was getting off at the next exit and instructed her to follow him. Sure enough, Dick turned onto an off-ramp leading to Highway 85, and even though Jean nearly missed the turn, the pursuing vehicle remained behind her. When Dick made it off the highway, he decided to turn onto a road located in the city of Sunnyvale and pulled over with Jean pulling over behind him. Jean was hoping that the male motorist might just decide to drive on, but instead, he pulled up behind Jean and came to a complete stop. Dick exited his truck, and when he walked past Jean's vehicle, he told her that he didn't recognize the driver, but advised her to stay with the car. Dick then walked over to the man's driver's side window to speak with him and asked him what he was doing. Jean claimed that the driver responded, but she couldn't make out what he said, though she did see him point towards the back of her car. According to Jean, the man's response caused Dick to become angry and give off a profane response, which was described by Jean in her Unsolved Mysteries interview as, quote, "Get the blankety blank out of here." However, this prompted the driver to pull out a gun and fire two shots into Dick. Upon hearing the shots, Jean looked back and saw that the man was staring directly at her, which left her frozen in fear, but after several seconds, he backed his vehicle away and drove off. When the vehicle was gone, Jean climbed out of her car and ran over to Dick, who was now lying wounded on the ground. He had been shot once in the chest and once in the neck. Shortly thereafter, another motorist pulled over to see what was happening and went to summon medical attention. When paramedics arrived at the scene, they transported Dick to a hospital, but he was pronounced dead shortly thereafter. The crime left everyone completely baffled, as there didn't seem to be any indication that either Dick or Jean knew the killer, or any motive for this man to have followed them for several miles to commit murder. It also seemed strange that the killer would decide to shoot Dick, but leave Jean behind as a living witness, but her story checked out, and she would be cleared as a suspect by police. The only potential motive investigators could come up with involved the personalized license plate on the back of Jean's vehicle, which read, 49er Hugs. This was a reference to the San Francisco 49ers team from the National Football League, and given that Dick was a large man who had been a college football player, there was speculation that the murder might have been a case of mistaken identity. In fact, while they were having dinner, Jean claimed that Dick was recognized by someone who mistakenly thought he was a current player for the 49ers. In the end, there was no evidence to support the theory that the murder was related to football, but the problem is that there was no evidence to support any particular theory, and the investigation failed to turn up a potential suspect. Over the course of the next 2 years, Jean would send several letters to Unsolved Mysteries, lobbying them to cover Dick's murder on the show, and the case was finally featured in an episode that aired in February of 1994. While the segment brought in a number of tips, it did not produce any solid leads. In 2014, the case would be profiled in an episode of the Investigation Discovery true crime series Dates from Hell, but once again, the investigation remained at a standstill, and after 28 years, the murder of Dick Hansen is still unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I stated in the intro, this case is sometimes referred to by Unsolved Mysteries fans as the 49er Hugs murder, as Jean's license plate was the only piece of evidence investigators could use to formulate a potential theory for this crime. To be honest with you, When I first saw this case featured on the show, I was always pretty skeptical about this theory, though I have become more open to it in recent years. When the case was featured on Dates from Hell a few years ago, they mentioned Dick being mistaken for a San Francisco 49ers player on the night of his murder, which was the first time this particular piece of information was ever revealed publicly, but I'll talk more about that in a little while. Sadly, as memorable as this story is, it doesn't sound like it's gotten a lot of coverage in the media, as there aren't many articles and resources available for it online, and it seems like the primary sources are the Unsolved Mysteries and Dates from Hell episodes. And unfortunately, there is some contradictory information about certain aspects of this case, particularly when it comes to the exact circumstances of Dick and Jean's date before the murder took place. Like I mentioned earlier, Jean's real name has never been released publicly. Since the Unsolved Mysteries episode aired only a few years after the crime, Jean still wanted to protect her identity, so she was interviewed on the show in silhouette, and her face was not shown on camera. By the time the Dates from Hell episode was produced, over 2 decades had passed, so this time, Jean was willing to show her face and appear on camera during her interview on the show, though it seems pretty apparent that she's wearing a wig in order to disguise herself a little bit. Now, the Unsolved Mysteries episode implied that Dick and Jean were just friends, and the reenactment actually showed them hanging out in a bar with a bunch of other people, making their encounter look like a big social gathering. But in the Dates from Hell episode, and virtually every other source I've seen about this case, it's very clear that Dick and Jean were on a date that night, and there's no indication that they hung out with anyone else. Perhaps Unsolved Mysteries fudged the facts a little bit, because Jean wanted to keep the details of the relationship private at that time. From what I can tell, they had been friends for a long time, and had an on-again, off-again relationship following Dick's divorce, but were not officially a couple when they went out that night, though they were certainly exploring that possibility. This was the first time they had gone out, since Dick completed alcohol rehabilitation, but there are differing accounts of what took place on their date. The Dates from Hell episode showed Dick getting angry with Jean at the restaurant because she didn't visit him in rehab, prompting him to order a drink out of spite. However, another article I read about the case states that Dick didn't drink any alcohol that night. Quite frankly, I would not be surprised if the detail about Dick ordering the drink at the restaurant was a piece of dramatic license for the show. This was the first time I ever watched an episode of Dates from Hell, and let's just say that it will probably be my last, as it's an overly sensationalized true crime show with ultra-cheesy reenactments. The way this episode was structured is to give the viewer the false impression that the date is going to go bad because Dick got drunk and did something bad to Jean, but in a surprise plot twist, Dick is the one who winds up being murdered by an unknown third party. For this reason, I do have to take some of the information presented in the Dates from Hell episode with a grain of salt. Right now, I'm going to discuss a piece of information often shared about this case, which I'm not sure is 100% true. There are a lot of rumors online that Dick had a recurring drug problem, and I believe this rumor originated from a post in the Web Sleuths forum from 2008, where a poster who claimed that Dick was one of his father's best friends in college mentioned that Dick had issues with drugs and that he had a hot temper. For this reason, one theory which is sometimes pushed forward in online discussions about this case is that Jean's story isn't 100% true, and that Dick's murder may have been the result of a drug deal gone bad. Well, it needs to be clarified that there has never been any official corroboration that Dick had a drug problem. Yes, it's been established that he had to go to rehab because of issues with alcohol, but the only source which has ever stated that Dick had issues with drugs is that aforementioned Web Sleuths post. I mean, it's certainly possible that Dick also had a drug problem, but even if he did, it might not have any relation to his murder. Let's put it this way. During the Unsolved Mysteries segment, the lead detective is quoted as saying, "What makes this case extremely difficult is that most homicides boil down to common denominators of sex, money, or drugs, and network out from there. We have not been able to put this particular homicide in any of these categories so that we can develop a motive." End quote. So that indicates to me that police never found any evidence to suggest that Dick's murder might be connected to drugs. Another prominent theory which often pops up in online discussions about this case is that Jean completely lied about her story and was somehow involved with Dick's murder, or, at the very least, knew more than she was telling. Yes, technically, we do only have Jean's word about how the events leading to the crime unfolded, as it doesn't seem like there were any other witnesses to corroborate her story. And the circumstances of the crime are so bizarre that they almost seem too unbelievable to be true, particularly when you consider that this unidentified motorist shot Dick right in front of Jean, yet inexplicably left her alive when he fled the scene. But I have not seen any indication that police ever considered Jean to be a suspect, and it sounds like she was ruled out relatively quickly. To me, the biggest sign that Jean is telling the complete truth is that she spent 2 years writing letters to Unsolved Mysteries to get his case featured on the show. In addition, at the time the segment originally aired, Jean actually went to the trouble of distributing flyers which announced that Dick's case was going to be on the show. I cannot imagine Jean would do any of this if she had something to hide, and it seems pretty clear that she genuinely wanted the murder to be solved. Honestly, I have to wonder if people push forward these wild theories about Dick's murder being the result of a drug deal gone bad, or Jean being the real killer, because the actual truth is pretty terrifying. Jean claimed that when Dick saw the driver of the car, he said he did not recognize him, so this may have been a completely random crime committed by someone who did not even know Dick, but felt the need to shoot him for completely inexplicable reasons. The idea of unknowingly setting off a complete stranger for reasons you don't understand, and then compelling them to follow you for over 10 miles before they decide to murder you, is scary. But it sounds like that might be exactly what happened in this case. But let's go back and retrace Dick and Jean's steps on the night this took place. We know that they met at the restaurant, Original Joe's, at 10 p.m, and after dinner, they drove to a nightclub 5 miles away in Jean's car, and left Dick's pickup truck parked outside the restaurant. They then left the club at 1:45 a.m., returned to the restaurant, and were parked behind Dick's truck chatting when this mysterious man showed up. What's unclear is whether this man just happened to pull up at that moment, or if he had been shadowing Dick and Jean earlier that night and followed them to that spot. When the man started following Dick and Jean in their separate vehicles, it almost seemed like he had a particular interest in Jean because he had been driving right behind her and copying her every move, such as when she changed lanes and slammed on the brakes. Yet when they finally pulled over, he decided to shoot Dick, but left Jean alive, so what exactly was his vendetta? Jean claims that she tried to tell Dick to drive to the police station, but he apparently could not hear her, which is why he made the decision to exit the interstate and pull over in order to confront the driver directly. I think this is one detail which has made people question the veracity of Jean's story. If you're being shadowed by a creepy motorist in the middle of the night, why would you decide to stop on a deserted road, exit your vehicle, and approach him? Well, let's not forget that Dick was a large 255-pound former football player. In one of the articles I read about this case, Dick was described by friends as having a knack for reasoning with unreasonable people. So perhaps Dick felt he could do the same thing here, and never imagined that this guy would shoot him. According to Jean, the driver pointed in her direction and said something which prompted Dick to say, "Get the blankety blank out of here." So the implication seems to be that the driver provided an absurd answer when Dick asked why he was following them. This is pretty much the main reason why a theory was formulated that the killer was pointing to Jean's 49er Hugs license plate and told Dick he was following them for a reason which was somehow related to the San Francisco 49ers. And of course, since Dick still had the build of a football player, the driver might have mistakenly assumed he was a player for the 49ers and decided to kill him for it, perhaps because he was a fan of a rival NFL team. That's not a rational reason to murder someone, but this guy was clearly not a rational man. Now, like I mentioned earlier, I used to be pretty skeptical of this theory, as we couldn't even be certain if the killer was actually pointing at Jean's license plate before he shot Dick. However, some new information revealed during the Dates from Hell episode has caused me to look at this theory in a different light. During the reenactments of Dick and Jean's date during this episode, they show two separate incidents where Dick is recognized by strangers who mistake him for a San Francisco 49ers player named Barry Hartman. Now, I'm not the biggest football fan, but a quick Google search shows that no one named Barry Hartman has ever played for the San Francisco 49ers, so I can only assume that the show came up with a fake name to protect the identity of the real player. In actuality, I think that Barry Hartman was a pseudonym for Harris Barton, who was an offensive lineman on the 49ers in 1991, and if you look at photographs of Barton, you will see that he actually does bear quite a resemblance to Dick, so I can definitely see how someone might have mixed the two men up. The episode also claims that Barry Hartman had recently received a lot of flack, as some people believed he cost the 49ers a shot at Super Bowl XXV, which took place only 3 months earlier. Well, let's look at the context of this situation. Prior to this, the 49ers won two consecutive Super Bowl championships and had the best record during the 1990 season, so they were heavily favored to win the Super Bowl for the third straight time. However, before they could make it that far, they were upset in the National Football Conference championship game by the New York Giants. The 49ers were leading 13-12 with just over 2 minutes remaining, but the running back, Roger Craig, fumbled the ball, allowing the Giants to take possession and eventually kick a field goal with seconds remaining to win 15-13. To this day, the game is still ranked as one of the most devastating losses in 49ers history. Now, even though the Dates from Hell episode implied that Dick was mistaken for a player who cost the 49ers a shot at the Super Bowl, there's no way he could have been mistaken for Roger Craig, the guy who fumbled the ball, since Craig is black. While Harris Barton was technically on the field when the 49ers blew the lead, I don't see how anyone could single-handedly blame the loss on him. But of course, fanatical sports fans can act pretty entitled sometimes and take it as a personal betrayal if they believe that one of their own players cost their team a big win. So let's assume that the killer mistook Dick for Harris Barton. If that's what happened, then this may not be a case of a fan of a rival NFL team committing murder because he hated the 49ers. Instead, the killer may have been a fanatical 49ers fan who thought they were killing Harris Barton out of revenge for costing their favorite team a championship. If the driver told Dick he was following him because he believed he was Barton, that's the type of thing which could have prompted Dick's angry reaction. And if his vendetta was with Dick because he mistook him for someone else, then this might explain why he left Gene alive. Of course, one of the biggest issues with this theory is that the 49er Hugs license plate was on Gene's vehicle, not Dick's. They got into separate vehicles when they drove away, but the perpetrator couldn't have known they were both planning to drive to the same location. His actions seemed to suggest that he was more interested in pursuing Gene than Dick, which goes against the idea that he wanted to kill Dick because he mistook him for a 49ers player. I think this mistaken identity theory would depend a lot on whether the killer had seen Dick on a previous occasion before he pulled up behind Gene's car outside the restaurant. Since Dick was chatting with Gene inside the car before he climbed into his own truck, I'm not sure if the driver would have gotten a good enough look at him to confuse him with Harris Barton. But if the perpetrator did believe Dick was Barton, he probably thought his crime was going to garner major headlines because he shot a star player for the San Francisco 49ers, so I'm sure he was shocked once he found out he killed the wrong person. However, if that wasn't the motive for this murder, and the killer was a complete stranger to Dick, what else could have possessed him to do this? Well, believe it or not, in the earliest media coverage of this case, Dick's father was interviewed, and he pushed forward a theory that the crime simply may have come about because Gene's car was parked in front of a mailbox. As you recall, when Gene first noticed the man pull up behind them, she thought he might have been waiting to use the mailbox and asked Dick if he should move forward, but he said not to worry, there was still plenty of room. Could it be possible that this guy originally showed up there to drop something in the mailbox, but when Gene's vehicle wouldn't move forward a few feet to clear his path, it somehow got him enraged enough to follow them for over 10 miles and commit murder? I know, that definitely sounds like major overkill, but sadly, a mentally unstable person can be driven to take someone's life over the most trivial thing. When Dick confronted this guy, he could have pointed to Gene's vehicle and complained that she blocked his path to the mailbox, and Dick likely would have found this explanation so ridiculous that it prompted him to drop a few F-bombs. I think one of the biggest obstacles to formulating a plausible motive for this murder is that you probably cannot apply logic to this situation at all, as the crime may have been set in motion by something completely mundane. Given his actions, it would not surprise me at all if the perpetrator has committed other murders besides this one. In fact, some people have pointed out that his composite sketch resembled the original composite of the Zodiac Killer. Given that this crime took place in Northern California, and the victim was seemingly chosen at random, I can see why it would be tempting to believe this, but I think the perpetrator was far too young to be the Zodiac. In the end, I do not think this crime was personal, or committed by someone with any connection to Dick or Jean. I don't completely discount the theory that the killer was a deranged football fan, and his motive had some sort of connection to the San Francisco 49ers, but I ultimately have a feeling that he just wanted to kill someone that night, and came up with his own twisted reason to select Dick as a victim. And that would explain why there have been no solid leads in the investigation for nearly 30 years, because crimes which are committed at random are often the hardest to solve. It's scary to think that a man may have lost his life simply because he crossed paths with a stranger who felt an urge to commit murder, but the explanation may really be that simple. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved murder of Dick Hansen, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, before I bring this episode to a close, I'm going to discuss another unsolved mysteries case about another senseless crime where a victim was shot by a motorist who seemingly selected them at random. Thankfully, the victim in this case survived, but when she was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, they concealed her identity by interviewing her in silhouette and referring to her by a pseudonym, Carol. Now, if you dig hard enough online, you can find the victim's real name, but since this crime is still unsolved, and she might not want the publicity again after all these years, I will keep her name private and still refer to her in this episode as Carol. So our second story begins in Connecticut in 1988, and our central figure is Carol, a 25-year-old married woman who lives in the town of Vernon and works a job as a psychotherapist at Day Kimball Hospital, a mental health facility located nearly an hour away in Putnam. Carol's job involves counseling depressed and mentally ill patients in order to help them reintegrate into society, and she normally drives a shortcut to work on a rural two-lane highway called Brayman Hollow Road, also known as Route 244. At around 9:30 a.m. on the morning of Monday, August the 22nd, Carol was running a half hour late and driving her usual route to the hospital when a black pickup truck suddenly pulled out in front of her. At first, the truck was driving very slowly, but as they continued along the road, the driver started to behave very erratically by randomly speeding up and slowing down. The truck would also swerve across the road, crossing the center line, and coming dangerously close to hitting other vehicles. When they were near the town of Pomfret, the pickup suddenly came to a complete stop in the middle of the road, blocking Carol's path. When Carol stopped her car, a white male with brown curly hair, who appeared to be in his late 20s or early 30s, suddenly emerged from the truck and approached her. He was carrying a large caliber revolver in his hand, and before Carol even had an opportunity to react, the man fired a shot through the driver's side window from 10 feet away. The bullet struck Carol in the face, 2 inches below her left eye, and she slumped down in the front seat as the gunman fled the scene. For the next several minutes, Carol's car remained parked on the road while a number of vehicles passed by, completely unaware that she was lying wounded in the front seat. It was not until a telephone repair truck with an elevated cab passed by that the driver was able to look down into Carol's car and see her body, prompting him to call for medical assistance. By the time police and paramedics arrived at the scene, Carol was still alive, but she had already lost 2 pints of blood. Carol was immediately rushed to a nearby hospital, but since there was uncertainty about whether or not she would survive, a detective would ride in the ambulance with Carol in order to question her about the shooting. She was only asked yes or no questions, and would respond by blinking her eyes once for yes and twice for no. After arriving at a local hospital, Carol was subsequently airlifted to Hartford Hospital for emergency surgery, where it was determined that her carotid artery had been severed, paralyzing her left vocal cord. But in the end, doctors were able to save her life and placed her in the intensive care unit. However, they were unable to remove the bullet which entered her cheek because it had become lodged in the back of her neck near her spine, and surgery ran the risk of causing paralysis. It would be over a year before an operation was finally performed to get the bullet out. Carol would be left with a scar on her face because of the bullet wound, but she was able to make a full recovery within a matter of months. police set up roadblocks in the area to search for the black truck, but while they were unable to locate it, they did speak to two motorists who claimed they had seen a black pickup truck repeatedly pulling on and off Brayman Hollow Road in the hour prior to Carroll's shooting. He appeared to be taunting other drivers and attempting to block their path. Investigators looked into Carroll's background, but even though her job involved working with mentally ill patients, there was no indication that any of them were responsible for shooting her, or that she had any known enemies. It seemed apparent that Carroll was selected completely at random by a stranger, and there was no discernible motive for this crime. Unfortunately, there were approximately 300,000 black pickup trucks registered in Connecticut at that time, and investigators had very little to go on in order to narrow them down to a potential suspect. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in January of 1990, but failed to bring about any solid leads, so Carroll's shooter continues to remain unidentified. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Now this is a case which Unsolved Mysteries fans often rank as one of the most frightening stories ever featured on the program, because it's the sort of crime which could happen to anyone. The victim was just on her normal route to work on a seemingly ordinary day until, for completely inexplicable reasons, some maniac just decided to pull his truck out in front of her and fire a bullet into her face, though thankfully, she did manage to pull through. I do think this is an important case to talk about, because it is so terrifying, but the reason I've added it as an epilogue to the Dick Hansen murder on this episode is because there really isn't all that much to talk about. We know exactly what happened, we just don't know the identity of the perpetrator or his motive. If Carroll had been killed and didn't get the opportunity to share the circumstances of how she was shot, police would have had virtually nothing to go on. Everything in the investigation seems to indicate that the crime was completely random, and the shooter did not know Carroll personally. Even though Carroll drove the same route to work every day, she was running a half hour later than usual on this particular morning, so theoretically, if someone was targeting her, they shouldn't have known that Carroll would be on that particular road at that particular time. Carroll's interviews on Unsolved Mysteries are pretty vivid, as she was filmed in silhouette in order to conceal her identity, but she was apparently left with a noticeable scar on her face. And at the time that interview was filmed, the bullet had not yet been removed from Carroll's neck, so she was living with a daily reminder of what happened to her. Believe it or not, on the day the Unsolved Mysteries episode originally aired, a number of local newspapers published articles about the case that used Carroll's real name, even though she kept her identity concealed in the program, which seems a bit counterproductive. Composite sketches in general are always pretty creepy to me, but the sketch of the curly-haired gunman is one of the more eerie ones, especially when you consider that Carroll only looked at that face for a few seconds before he fired a bullet into her. Afterward, Carroll described the experience as almost feeling like she was paralyzed, as she was lying wounded in her front seat and could hear the sound of her radio and the passing cars, but was physically incapable of doing anything. One of the most chilling quotes on Unsolved Mysteries was from the lead detective when he stated, quote, "It's the general feeling of investigators that the suspect is still out in the area, still going to work, still going to the same gas station. He's just your average citizen who, for whatever reason on this particular morning, was either under the influence or angry. We just don't know what provoked him to do this," end quote. And that's a pretty scary thought, as this shooter could have been an ordinary person living an ordinary life, but something within him just snapped and caused him to shoot a completely innocent stranger. The key difference between this story and the Dick Hansen murder is that the perpetrator seemed to develop a fixation on Dick and followed him for miles before committing the crime, but here, we really have no idea what prompted the gunman to choose Carroll. In Dick's case, the victim might have unknowingly did something to set the killer off, but it doesn't sound like that occurred here. We have multiple eyewitness accounts of a black pickup truck displaying erratic behavior and taunting motorists on that same road before Carroll even drove by that morning. It's apparent he was looking for trouble, and perhaps he was building up the nerve to shoot somebody, and Carroll just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time when he decided to go through with it. I'm not even sure I'd classify this as a road rage case, because it doesn't sound like Carroll did anything which might have set him off. He simply pulled out his truck in front of her and drove erratically for a short period of time before he suddenly decided to stop in the middle of the road and climb out to shoot her. He also didn't even bother to check and make sure Carol was dead before he fled the scene. I don't know if this is the only murder this person has ever committed, but it would not surprise me at all if he has inflicted violence on other people in his life before. Anyway, like I mentioned earlier, crimes which are committed at random are often the hardest to solve, as all investigators had in this case were a description of a suspect in a black pickup truck, but nothing more concrete which could help them narrow things down. Given that over 30 years have passed, I'm not sure this crime will ever be solved, but it would be nice to know that a person who is capable of such a senseless and horrific act of violence like this is no longer out there on the street. So if by chance you happen to have any information about this shooting, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about either of today's cases, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past year, we've already produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in Tiers 2 and 3, and we recently released a bonus episode titled The Crime Con Chronicles, in which I share my personal experiences attending Crime Con these past 3 years. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also released a new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up to join us on Patreon this week, and they are John T, Dana P, Jeffrey V, David F, Zell, and ASTT100. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which has a number of interesting threads about today's featured cases. Need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another brand new edition of The Trail Went Cold.